The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Hello, everyone, and thank you for coming, despite the inclement weather, which unfortunately will be with us all day. I hope you'll also be joining us later for Paul Krugman when he gives his talk. Just a reminder, as always, please turn off your cell phones and refrain from taking pictures. I'm excited about today's guest. I met him about 15 years ago when he was the editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster, and a position which he held for quite a while, which I'll mention in a moment. And he introduced me to the works of some of my favorite authors today, including David McCullough and Leslie Marmon Silko. The career of Michael Korda has been an invisible hand in all of our lives. If you have read a book by David McCullough, Jacqueline Suzanne, Harold Robbins, Mary Higgins Clark, Ronald Reagan, Henry Kissinger, or Larry McMurtry, you know Mr. Korda's work. He joined Simon & Schuster in 1958 as Henry Simon's editorial assistant, and 10 years later became editor-in-chief. He retired in 2005 after 47 years in the business and continues on as editor-in-chief emeritus, editing the works of David McCullough, Mary Higgins Clark, and many, many others. Korda is the best-selling author of 20 books, including Queenie, The Fortune, Ulysses S. Grant, Charmed Lives, and the number one bestseller, Power. More recently, he has published the books Cat People and Horse Housekeeping with his wife, Margaret. Today, he joins us to discuss his latest work, Ike, An American Hero, which the Wall Street Journal describes in the following manner. Michael Korda has produced a sweeping, crisply written account of Eisenhower's meteoric rise through the ranks and his leadership of the war against Nazi Germany. Mr. Korda seems to have read virtually everything written on Eisenhower's military career and has done a superb job of turning such material into a readable, vibrant narrative, a great American story well told. Please join me in welcoming Michael Korda.
Good morning. Ours is neither a nation nor a culture much given to extended hero worship. Ralph Waldo Emerson understood his own countrymen only too well when he wrote, "Every hero becomes a bore at last." After all, within Emerson's own lifetime, he would see both Andrew Jackson and Ulysses S. Grant cut down to size. There is simply no place in American life for the enduring national cult of a hero, no equivalent of France's fierce national passion for Napoleon, a cult strangely by no means limited to the French, or England's sentimental hero worship of Nelson and increasingly of Winston Churchill. Perhaps it is the price of being a democracy and of a deep, inherent distrust of the very idea of an elite. Americans are all egalitarians at heart, or at least feel the need to pay homage to the idea. We have a natural tendency to nibble away at the great figures of our past, to cut them down to size, to dig through their lives for flaws, mistakes, and weaknesses, to judge them severely by the standards and beliefs of the present rather than those that prevailed when they were alive. Thus, Washington has been marginalized as a, quote, dead white male, unquote, as well as a slave owner and remembered more for his ill-fitting false teeth and the contrived story of the cherry tree than for his generalship. Thus, Jefferson has been downgraded from his lofty position as the author of the Declaration of Independence to being treated not only as another slave owner, but as a hypocrite and a spendthrift. Thus, Grant's tomb, sits forlorn and seldom visited on Riverside Drive and 122nd Street in New York City, despite the fact that it was, until the end of the 19th century, a bigger tourist attraction than the Statue of Liberty. It is a simple fact of American life, this urge to splash graffiti on the pantheon of our national heroes. In other countries or cultures, the building up of national heroes is a full-time job, respected and well-rewarded. In France, with membership in the Académie Française and the Légion d'honneur. In the United Kingdom, with knighthoods and a cozy place in the cultural establishment. While in ours, whole profitable segments of the media and publishing industries prosper by tearing them down. Sic transit gloria mundi might as well be our national motto. Already in his own lifetime, for example, Dwight D. Eisenhower underwent a rapid transition from world-class five-star hero status to being dismissed by many as out of touch with what was happening in the country. More interested in his golf score than in politics, deaf or at least hard of hearing to the pleas of civil rights leaders, and towards the end of his 8 years in office, overshadowed by the youth and glamour of Jack Kennedy. The 1950s, the, quote, Eisenhower years, unquote, still conjure up a world that seems far removed from our own, even to those who came of age in it. Men wearing hats with narrow brims, suits with narrow lapels, huge great tail fin cars gleaming with chrome and guzzling gas, the dizzyingly rapid growth of the suburbs, the fiction of women as happy contented housewives, McCarthyism, the height of the Cold War, the threat of nuclear warfare, the missile gap, an age when cigarettes weren't considered harmful, the pill had yet to be invented, hemlines ended below the knee, and conformity, at least on the surface, ruled the land. Ike, as he was referred to by everyone, presided over this now vanished America, benign, avuncular, occasionally exasperated. His idea of a good evening was said to be watching old westerns on television, the President and Mrs. Eisenhower seated side by side in front of the set with a television tray for each of them. His idea of a good meal was said to be a scotch on the rocks and a steak. Although Ike, with his big trademark grin, looked like a gregarious soul, this was in part a facade or a protective mechanism, like a lot of things about him. True, he had grown up poor in Abilene, Kansas, but he was also a West Pointer, a five-star general, a former Supreme Commander, a man who, to quote Kipling, had walked with kings nor lost the common touch, and dealt as an equal with Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, and De Gaulle. Decades after serving two terms as his vice president, Richard Nixon was still complaining to anyone who would listen that the Eisenhowers had never invited the Nixons to a private dinner at the White House, just the four of them together, a subject about which Mrs. Nixon often expressed to the very end of her life what was for her a very rare degree of personal resentment. It has become conventional wisdom to believe that Ike's heart wasn't in politics, that like another victorious American general, Ulysses S. Grant, he accepted the presidency more out of a sense of obligation and as a reward for his victories than from any desire to run the country. But this is untrue, part of the Ike myth. The real Ike was a supremely gifted politician with an intimate knowledge of Washington and how it works, gained in part from serving 7 years as General Douglas MacArthur's military aide. He was also fiercely ambitious and competitive, with a carefully honed gift for concealing that fact. He had a terrifying hair-trigger temper, despite the big smile and the firm handshake, and a brilliant first-rate mind which he did his best to hide, partly out of genuine modesty, partly because he had learned how to play poker from a master as a boy in his teens. Indeed, throughout his long career in uniform, Ike was widely recognized as the best poker and bridge player in the United States Army in an age when that still mattered. And not surprisingly, as a soldier, he could curse like a trooper. Henry Kissinger still remembers today being on the receiving end of a diatribe from Ike over the phone when he first became Nixon's national security advisor. Nobody Kissinger told me, had ever spoken to him like that before or since. I heard words, Kissinger said, that I had never before heard in the English language. Ike was in a hospital bed on oxygen after a heart attack, and he cursed me for 5 minutes without stopping or pausing for breath. In short, the Ike people imagine him to have been was a very different person from the real Ike. There is more even to Ike's skill as a card player than meets the eye, for Ike came on his father's side from solid Mennonite stock. Bearded, German-speaking farmers, not unlike their neighbors in Pennsylvania, the Amish, who refused to allow card playing, liquor, or smoking in their homes, and who were above all scrupulous pacifists. Indeed, it was the central tenet of their faith. His beloved mother came from a similar background and for a time wore the prayer cap, the long dress buttoned to the neck, the starched cotton apron, the prayer apron, down to the shoes, but became in midlife converted to Jehovah's Witnesses, a religion which also condemned card playing and is even more devoted to complete pacifism than the Mennonites. How the boy from Abilene, to which his grandfather and many other Pennsylvania Mennonites had moved after the Civil War, grew up to attend the United States Military Academy and make warfare his career, as well as to support himself as a cadet and a second lieutenant, largely on his poker winnings, is one of the many mysteries in Ike's life for a biographer to explore. Sufficient to say, his was not a simple character. One of the saddest things about the way our country no longer learns or teaches its own history, let alone anybody else's, is that everybody of any consequence in it gets ruthlessly oversimplified and distorted. Some attention is paid to Lincoln's complexity because he is our national martyr. But what do people, even supposedly well-educated people, really know today about Woodrow Wilson, say, or Franklin Delano Roosevelt, or Dwight D. Eisenhower? Let us begin with the obvious. With the possible exception of Ulysses S. Grant, Ike was the best general this country has ever produced. He planned and led not one but three enormous, unprecedented, and ultimately successful amphibious invasions of North Africa in 1942, of Sicily in 1943, and of Normandy in 1944. We must remember, too, that while history gives us as nothing else a window into the past, those who are living through it have no such clear view ahead. Germany was at the peak of her power in 1942, and there seemed no good reason why Hitler should not win the war. Victory was not, and never was, a sure thing. It took Ike 6 months and cost over 70,000 casualties to win in Tunisia. The Germans fought fiercely in Sicily, despite the collapse of their Italian ally, and D-Day was the narrowest of triumphs and might easily have turned into a disaster. It was Ike's task to defeat and destroy the armed forces of Nazi Germany, an army that was still second to none in experience, professional skill, and fighting spirit, and driven by a level of fanaticism that was still a formidable asset. Because we look backwards at Ike's victory, we tend to assume that they were inevitable, but they were nothing of the sort. Nor was Ike just a successful general. He was a supreme commander, leading a coalition of fractious and difficult allies to victory, the hardest job in warfare. We now live in an age when a four-star general in Iraq commands, if he is lucky, perhaps 160,000 troops in the field. In June of 1944, Ike commanded over 3 million men, 1.7 million of them American, 1 million of them British and Canadian, the rest Free French, Polish, Norwegian, Czech, Belgian, and Dutch. Not since the Duke of Wellington in 1815, before and during the Battle of Waterloo, had one man ever commanded such an international force. It was also the largest international alliance in history and surely the most formidable. Ike had under his command over 11,000 aircraft and 7,000 ships. He had 170,000 men already at sea as he sat down at 9:30 p.m. on the night of June 4, 1944, in the middle of continuing bad weather and high seas, to make the final decision as to whether to carry out the invasion of Europe on June 6 or postpone it until later in the month or even to July. He was supreme commander, Allied forces in Europe. It was his decision and his alone to make. He was under no obligation to consult with anybody, nor did he. Ike's orders simply read, quote, "You will enter the continent of Europe and, in conjunction with the other United Nations, undertake operations aimed at the heart of Germany and at the total destruction of her armed forces." As Ike sat chain-smoking in the library of Southwark House near Portsmouth, listening to the wind and the rain rattle the blacked-out windows, the full responsibility for the most momentous and critical decision of World War II rested entirely on his shoulders. The meteorologists had given their forecast. His ground commander, General Sir Bernard Montgomery, had given his opinion, as had his naval commander, Admiral Sir Bertram Ramsay, his air commander, Air Chief Marshal Sir Trafford Leigh Mallory, and his deputy, Air Chief Marshal Sir Arthur Tedder. There was nothing more to learn or to say. Ike did not call Washington for advice or orders. He sat in silence, smoking, for almost 3 minutes. Those who were present remember the ticking of a clock in the room. Then he sighed and got up and said, "I am quite positive I must give the order. I don't like it, but there it is. I don't see how I can do anything else." Then, as his subordinate commanders rushed off to the telephones and the telex machines, Ike stood up and left the room. He had given the order. The invasion would take place on the morning of June 6, and nothing could stop it now. And he went back through the rain to the simple trailer where he lived and sat down to write on a small piece of paper with his fountain pen what he would say to the press on the morning of June 6 if the invasion failed. He wrote, "Our landings in the Cherbourg-Havre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based on the best information. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone." He folded this note up and put it in the breast pocket of his short uniform jacket. It was already becoming known as an Eisenhower jacket, and buttoned the pocket so he would know where to find it if he needed it. As we all know, he would not need it. The chances of the invasion succeeding, he rated at no better than 50-50, even if the weather were good and it was terrible. It was the greatest gamble of the war. But Ike brought it off. The note was never read. There is, however, in this glimpse of Ike, everything that made him a great commander and an American hero. Humility, the strength to accept crushing responsibility, the willingness to admit it when he made a mistake, the courage to do what looked like the impossible, and to do it with a grin that made it look easy. It is easy now to forget the battles he fought and won, about how he turned a humiliating defeat in Tunisia into a victory, at one point advancing himself towards a German attack with his pistol drawn, perhaps the only full general to do such a thing in the history of both world wars. It is easy now to forget about how hard that war was and how much of it was fought under Ike's command. The near thing at Salerno, when Allied armies were almost driven off the beaches by the sheer ferocity of the German counterattack, and when destroyers came in so close to the shore that they fought gun duels with German Tiger tanks on the beaches until the tubes of their own guns turned red hot. It is easy to forget about the Battle of Saint-Lô and the slaughter that took there, and the closing of the Falaise Gap when men advanced over the bodies of thousands, about the liberation of Paris and the airborne drop on Arnhem, and the Battle of the Bulge and the crossing of the Rhine at Remagen. In each of these battles, through all the tragedies and catastrophes of war, I kept his cool, retained and communicated to all his soldiers, whatever their rank, his optimism, stuck to his plans, dealt with such difficult subordinates as Monty and George Patton, chose and defended against such vehement political prima donnas as Winston Churchill, Charles de Gaulle, and Stalin, his own strategy for victory, and in the end achieved just what he had promised to do when he accepted the German surrender at Reims and addressed a German general for the first and only time in the war, telling Colonel General Jodl, who would later be hung at Nuremberg, "You will officially and personally be held responsible if the terms of this surrender are violated, including its provision for German commanders to appear in Berlin at the moment set by the Russian High Command to accomplish the formal surrender to that government. That is all. You are dismissed." He then dictated a cable to Washington with the shortest, most personally modest, and least triumphalist message of victory since that of Grant's for Appomattox in 1815. It read, "The mission of this Allied force was fulfilled at 0241 local time, May 7th, 1945, signed Eisenhower." Ike went on from that great victory to become president of Columbia University, the architect and first supreme commander of NATO, and eventually president of the United States. As president, he ended the war in Korea with an armistice that is still in place 56 years later. He guided the country through the dangers of the Cold War. He kept the peace for 8 years. He presided over the rebuilding of Europe. And when challenged by Governor Orville Faubus of Arkansas over the Supreme Court decision requiring the end of school segregation, Ike rejected the use of U.S. Marshals and FBI agents and instead unhesitatingly used a battalion fully armed of troopers of the 101st Airborne, one of the airborne divisions that had dropped at his orders on the night of June 5, 1944, to escort black students through angry segregationist mobs into high school. Ike wanted peace, yearned and worked for it at home and abroad. But he knew that when the United States was obliged to use force, whether it was in Little Rock or Normandy, it must be maximum, irresistible force, with the moral backing and the involvement of all Americans in support out of a well-thought-out plan for total victory. He is best summed up in his own words that are as important today as they were nearly 50 years ago when he was president and should perhaps be studied with some attention by those in office and by those who aspire to the Oval Office. On the subject of defense, for example, Ike said, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired represents in the final analysis a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, who are cold and not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children." How few generals, how few presidents have ever spoken so eloquently on the subject of defense spending as that? On the subject of Vietnam, Ike said, and I quote him, "No one could be more bitterly opposed to ever getting the United States involved in a hot war in that region than I am. I could not conceive of a greater tragedy for America." On the subject of Social Security, the boy who had grown up poor in Abilene defied the right wing of his own party and said, "Should any political party attempt to abolish or tinker with Social Security, you would not hear of that party again in our political history." Nobody would have been more angry than Ike at recent attempts to undermine Social Security. Ike has a certain reputation for garbled syntax in his speeches, but I have to say that on matters that concerned him, he spoke and wrote with the clarity that always characterized his orders. For example, on a subject that concerns us all today, we might do well to listen to what Ike had to say. "The United States," he said, has no business transforming itself into an occupying power in a seething Arab world. I am sure we would regret it. I don't think anybody could have put it better. And this from the man who had conquered Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, and therefore knew whereof he spoke. It is time, I believe, to recognize not only Dwight D. Eisenhower's skill as a general, but his wisdom and humanity as a president, and to appreciate the extent to which the survival of America depended for decades on his homespun virtues. Honesty, modesty, hard work, devotion to duty, personal courage. He was, I believe, a true American hero. It was a pleasure to write about him.
Folks, if you have a question, and I'm sure you do,
I'd be happy to answer any questions on Ike or anything else come to that, but
what he
my
said.
Knowledge has its limits, however.
Okay, we'll start right here. 1, 2, 3, the fourth row.
Thank you very much. This has been wonderful.
Thank you.
And how did he ever speak about him after he became president?
I understood the first part of that question. I must tell you that as a legacy of having fought in the Hungarian Revolution, I'm unhappily somewhat deaf. So, what was the second part of the question?
About Eisenhower and MacArthur. MacArthur was out before he became president, but he did serve under him. How did they get along, and did he have anything to say about MacArthur after he became president?
Let me start out by saying that the 7 years during which Ike served as General MacArthur's aide, Ike was then a major, and MacArthur, as Army Chief of Staff, was a four-star general. So there was a huge gulf between them in rank. There was also a huge gulf between them in that MacArthur was a society figure, a personal friend of every president, a First World War hero, whereas Ike never got overseas in the First World War, and had every decoration from every nation running from here to here, whereas Ike had only one or two little ribbons himself. I think I can best start by saying that in 1945, when they were both five-star generals and supreme commanders, a lady came up to General MacArthur and asked him if he knew General Eisenhower. General MacArthur gave her a steely look and said, "Yes, ma'am, I do know General Eisenhower. Best clerk I ever had." There's also another story which I like even better, that in 1945 in Tokyo, one of MacArthur's aides informed him that the Canadians had named a mountain after General Eisenhower, and MacArthur sent the aide for an atlas and a magnifying glass and searched the Canadian mountains with the magnifying glass until he found the mountain, and then nodded his head as he stood up and said, "Given the terrain, mighty small mountain." Ike, on the other hand, when a lady came up to him and asked if he knew General MacArthur, replied, "Yes, ma'am, I do. I studied dramatics under him for 7 years." Ike had a steadily fueled sense of resentment and of deep ambivalence on the subject of General MacArthur. As early as the first days of 1942, right after Pearl Harbor, when Ike returned to Washington and was placed by General Marshall in the War Department and promoted to Brigadier General. Ike recommended strongly, both to President Roosevelt and to Marshall, against awarding MacArthur a Medal of Honor, which he did not think MacArthur deserved and which he thought would cause trouble with the troops. He disliked MacArthur's theatricality. He disliked MacArthur's right-wing political ideas. He respected MacArthur's competence as a general, although they were different kinds of generals to a very large degree. After the war, to their mutual embarrassment, when Ike replaced Marshall as Army Chief of Staff, theoretically, and this is a part of my book I had great fun writing, theoretically, General MacArthur became Ike's subordinate, although by that time, MacArthur in Tokyo, as Supreme Commander and American plenipotentiary to Japan, lived essentially the life of a god, and neither corresponded with Washington nor answered cables and letters from Washington. And in the end, Ike was forced to fly all the way to the Pacific in order to meet with MacArthur, a meeting which both of them remembered afterwards with exceeding bad feelings. MacArthur was fired by Truman, and even though Ike thought Truman was right to do so, he nevertheless felt that MacArthur had brought it on himself by carrying the war in Korea too far north and then recommending that the only way to get out of the mess that he had put himself in was to use atomic weapons. That was a point of view which Ike never shared. I may add, because it's an interesting sidelight, that Ike did not know of the building of the atomic bomb until after the war in Europe was over, when he was informed by Secretary of War Stimson at the Potsdam Conference that the atomic bomb existed. Stimson also informed him that it was the intention to use the atomic bomb against the Japanese within a number of weeks. And Ike, who had, as I pointed out to you, a ferocious temper, had one of his real outbursts of temper on that subject. He said, and he repeated it to Truman with great anger at their first meeting in Potsdam. He had never before met Truman or vice versa, that he thought it was absolutely wrong to use this weapon against the Japanese when it was well known that they were attempting to surrender in every neutral capital of the world, when the Soviet Union was joining at last in the war against Japan so that the Japanese would be quickly overrun from the north, and he thought that it would tarnish the American reputation and the American victory. And with a phrase which is unforgettable, he pointed out to President Truman, "Once you have taken the genie out of the bottle, you will never get him back in again." It is that angry argument with Stinson and Truman over the use of the atomic bomb against the Japanese that started the real dislike that always existed between Ike and Truman and led to many other problems. Nevertheless, I have to say that I have in the book a photograph of Ike at the moment where he has been told that Truman has fired MacArthur. And the expression on his face says everything that you need to know, because it is the expression, whatever his personal feelings were about General MacArthur, of one five-star general for another five-star general, having been fired by a reserve artillery captain and politician. It is a look of absolute horror and amazement, and anybody who has the book, gets it or reads it, I suggest you turn to that page because it's one of the funniest pictures ever taken of Eisenhower.
Take another question. 1, 2, 3, 4 rows back here. Gentleman with his hand up. Keep your hand up, sir. Could you wait for the microphone, please?
General Marshall was against the taking of the war first to North Africa. He wanted to, my understanding, he wanted to go first into France. Where did Eisenhower stand on this? And in retrospect, how do you view that decision to go to North Africa?
I don't have too many doubts about it, nor did Ike. In 1942, the Americans had one untested combat division in England and proposed to put 3 to 5 divisions towards the end of 1942 or the beginning of 1943 ashore in Brittany against the Germans. That would have placed probably 2 British and Canadian divisions and 1 untrained and untested American division against approximately 35 hardened, battle-trained, well-led and well-equipped German divisions in France, and would have been a disaster, in addition to which none of the sophisticated equipment which was required for the invasion as yet existed. There were no LSTs, there were no LCTs, there were no landing ships, there were no Higgins boats. I'm not saying that it couldn't have been done. I'm saying that it would have merely led to the unnecessary slaughter of 2 British and Canadian divisions and 1 American division. Ike, because he was in London, perceived, I think, more clearly than Marshall did, what an impossibility it would be to invade until we were ready to do so. Hence, his invasion of North Africa and Sicily. A tremendous amount of building and training and equipping had to be done. It's very doubtful, in my mind, that we could have invaded Europe at any time much before June of 1944. And even when we invaded in June of 1944, it was that close. It could easily have been a disaster. If that happens to be one of the few things about which I think Marshall is wrong, and it's fairly clear in the Marshall-Ike correspondence that though Ike holds himself back in writing to Marshall because of his respect for Marshall, that Ike had already figured out for himself that it just wasn't going to happen.
Another question. Gentleman 7 rows back with the beige jacket.
Thank you for coming to the Free Library, and thank you for returning Eisenhower to the hero status. My question is with regard to his selection of John Foster Dulles as Secretary of State and Dulles' brother as head of the CIA, and how he, what kind of relationship did you see in terms of their working together?
Let me begin answering that question by pointing out, though I'm sure you know this, but you have to see it as the background, that when Ike was elected to the presidency, the Republican Party was probably the single subject about which he was the most ignorant. It had been somewhat doubtful in most people's minds, and I think to a degree in Ike's mind, whether he was a Democrat or a Republican. In 1947, despite their furious quarrel in 1945 over the use of the atomic bomb against the Japanese, Truman had suggested to Ike that he would not mind stepping down in 1948 if Ike would run as the Democratic nominee for the presidency. Truman would step down and run as his vice president. Probably, in fact, certainly, the only time that any president has ever made such an offer to anyone in American history. Ike turned it down partly because already he and Truman disliked each other, and partly because he was still a serving officer, and partly because he wasn't altogether sure whether he was a Democrat or not. Throughout the 1950s, he became increasingly Republican in his views, which is not surprising, coming as he did from Kansas and a Mennonite family in which the Republican Party equated with Abraham Lincoln rather than with Senator Robert Taft. And yet Ike knew very little about the Republicans themselves, and I have to say, didn't work very hard to get to know them any better. So his choice of the Dulles brothers was one that he made on good recommendations. John Foster Dulles and I got along extremely well, which is surprising because nobody else got along with John Foster Dulles at all well. And he was given to lecturing Ike, which Ike didn't like a bit. But he trusted John Foster Dulles, and above all, he thought that John Foster Dulles knew how to be tough with the Russians, and it was already clear that being tough with the Russians was going to be the principal job of the Secretary of State for many years to come. What Ike's relationships with Allen Dulles are is harder to say. Allen Dulles had been a spymaster for the CIA in Switzerland, so Ike certainly knew of him during the war. But increasingly, through Ike's two terms as president, he felt more and more often let down by the CIA. And I think that that probably affected his view of Allen Dulles. In general, I would say that Ike picked competent people of strong personality for his cabinet, but for whom he had no special warmth or connection.
Another question, right here in the front row. Sir, could you wait for the mic, please?
What were Eisenhower's rationale or thoughts about the Hungarian Revolution?
What was Eisenhower's...
Rationale and thoughts about the Hungarian Revolution?
Well, of course, this is a difficult question for me to answer objectively because I was in the Hungarian Revolution. But Ike was not in any doubt about what should be done about the Hungarian uprising in October of 1956. Hungary did not share any border with the West. The only border that it had was with Austria, which all four powers had created as a neutral country after World War II. There was no practical way in which the United States could have reached Hungary had they wanted to, without crossing Austria, which they were not able to do. In addition to which, the Russians, and I've made that very clear in my own book about the Hungarian Revolution, the Politburo made it abundantly clear that they could and would use atomic weapons if the United States crossed the border and tried to aid the Hungarian revolutionaries. Ike himself said that it would have been easier to come to the support of people in Tibet than it was to come to the support of people in Hungary. And as a general, Ike knew what he was talking about. I don't think Ike had any deep regrets for what happened. He thought that he did the sensible thing. He was facing a moment at which the war in Egypt over the Suez Canal might at any moment turn into a nuclear war if the Russians pressed their point, as they threatened to do, and he had no great wish to set off a nuclear war in Europe, which might well have been the case had he tried to help the Hungarians. I must also tell you that as somebody who was with the Hungarian freedom fighters throughout the entire revolution, that nobody that I met in Hungary even remotely expected that the United States would help them. I know that Radio Free Europe constantly suggested that this might be so, but I never met anybody in Hungary who thought the Americans were going to come trundling across the Austrian border with two or three divisions of armor. And had they done so, I don't think there's any question that the Russians would have fought. So I think it's kind of, it's an unquestion. The Hungarians, the only way in which the Hungarian Revolution would have succeeded is if at the very beginning, Imre Nagy had been able to carefully solidly tamp down the fires of the revolt sufficient to begin a discussion with the Russians. Some form of slightly more democratic socialism might have been reached peacefully if he'd been able to do that. But unfortunately, By the time he came to power, the revolution was out of control. And when the people in the streets started to hang and sometimes burn the bodies of communists whom they had captured and secret policemen whom they had captured, if you read the minutes, which are now available, of the Politburo meetings in Moscow, that is the point at which Khrushchev said, you know, we cannot allow this to happen. We're going to crush it. It was a revolution out of control, but I don't believe the United States could have done a single thing about it, and neither did Ike.
Unfortunately, we only have time for a handful of questions, so we'll try to get to as many of you as we can. Gentleman in the black here, about 10 rows back.
I think one of the occurrences that caused many of us to have some less than favorable opinion about Eisenhower was his reaction to the slur of McCarthy against Marshall in the campaign, and I would like you to comment on that.
Let me begin by saying that in a long book, I don't claim that Eisenhower didn't make mistakes or that he didn't do things that I would have just, or that he didn't do things which are hard to justify. However, I think this has to be put in the context of two things. First of all, it's usually supposed by historians that Ike and Marshall got along well together. I don't find any evidence of that. They were never, ever on first-term basis. Only once in his lifetime did Marshall ever refer to Eisenhower as Ike, and he was so embarrassed at having done it that he used the words General Eisenhower six times in the next minute. Ike felt very strongly that when he had asked after the war if Mamie could join him in Germany at his headquarters, he had expected Marshall to agree to that, instead of which Marshall took the letter to President Truman, and President Truman, whose feeling was that since the ordinary soldiers could not have their wives there, Ike certainly could not either, told Marshall to write back and deny Eisenhower that request. I think it is fair to say that Ike never forgave Marshall for that. He regarded it as a betrayal and as unfair and as wrong. So I'm not so sure that, as a human being, Ike was as eager to leap to the defense of General Marshall, much as he admired his work as Secretary of State and Chief of Staff, as is generally supposed. In addition to which, his view of McCarthy, while it was colored by his anger, and one only has to look at Ike on television speaking about Shine and Cone to see real Ike anger, you know, face red, veins throbbing, furious. Nevertheless, his considered judgment was that McCarthy was such a dumb, misguided, and evil son of a bitch that if you gave him enough rope, he would hang himself. And that's exactly what happened. Now, it would no doubt make us all feel better about Ike if Ike had helped hang him. But, you know, Ike's feeling as a Republican and as a general was that you didn't have to do that because McCarthy would destroy himself, and indeed he did. So while I can't ask you necessarily to share Ike's strategy, that was Ike's strategy. And he makes no bones about it in his the first volume of his presidential memoirs. He sets it out quite firmly and openly as the way he chose to handle the McCarthy problem.
Leading on the aisle, about 12 rows back.
This has been most informative, and we thank you very much for coming to our library.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure indeed. I wonder if you would comment about Eisenhower's participation with MacArthur during the Veterans Bonus Army in Washington.
Yes, I'd be happy to. Ike was then MacArthur's aide. MacArthur, as Army Chief of Staff, was a four-star general, and Ike was a major. It was then the custom for all officers serving in Washington to wear civilian clothes. By the way, a custom which I think is very good. I think there's no call whatsoever for officers at the Pentagon to dress in full uniform, let alone, which is even more ridiculous, in combat uniform and great big clunky boots. Until fairly recently, officers serving in Washington were expected to wear respectable civilian suits. And MacArthur always did. MacArthur saw the bonus marchers, in part because that's the way Hoover saw them, but also because it's the way he saw them, as the beginning of a dangerous revolution. And he went back to his quarters and changed into full uniform with ribbons from here to here, and ordered Ike to do the same. Ike objected to that and said he thought it was a mistake, and MacArthur said, that's an order. So Ike went back and changed the uniform and came back. MacArthur had ordered the troops out to stop the bonus marchers marching and to evacuate them from the makeshift camps in which they'd been living for some months. Ike felt that A, that MacArthur was overstepping his orders, B, that MacArthur ignored and deliberately ignored an order brought to him by a staff officer telling him not to use military force, and finally, that if MacArthur was going to use military force, then the best thing he could do would be to get out of sight. And MacArthur ignored all of those things. He went ahead despite the order which he'd ignored to use military force. He used it vehemently and in much too great a number. And he was photographed vaingloriously strutting about in his full uniform while this whole painful episode took place. Ike was ashamed for himself. He was infuriated at MacArthur. It remained forever something that he talked about with loathing. And it's something which, had he been able to prevent it, he would absolutely have prevented it. But there is no way that a major is going to prevent a four-star general from doing what he has set out to do.
We've got time for one more question. Gentleman in the blue on my left there with his hand up. Sir, please wait for the microphone.
I had the pleasure once of taking a brief, unscheduled walk with the Nobel Prize winner, I.I. Robbie. And he, this was at Columbia University, and of course Eisenhower had been president of Columbia University, and the subject of Eisenhower came up during that walk. I.I. Robbie thought, and he said to me, that Eisenhower was the most misunderstood bright man he ever met. This was a man who was a true intellect, according to a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. And I'm haunted by that, and I'm asking you to give me an A and B comparison, if you will, or some comment on the egghead. And that's the genesis of the word egghead was Adlai Stevenson, who ran against Eisenhower a couple of times. That was the egghead, and Eisenhower was the non-egghead. And yet there is a Nobel Prize winner saying to me, you got it wrong.
Would you comment? Yes, Robbie was absolutely correct. The answer to that is, first of all, I came from Abilene, Kansas. Let me just say, Kansas is not a place where if you're smart, you go about showing it or showing it off. So from a very early age, Ike learned that smart as he was and well-read as he was, it was best to conceal it. That was the family way of doing things. All the Eisenhower boys were successful. But it was the way things were done in Kansas and the way things were done in the Eisenhower family. Secondly, every once in a while, something would happen that he couldn't control. When Ike never wanted to be an army officer, never wanted to serve, be a soldier at all. His mother was a pacifist. His father was a pacifist. He sat for military academy exam in the days when Annapolis and West Point had the same examination. He took one exam for both academies and came in second in the state of Kansas, which already argues for a considerable degree of academic skill, and was quite content with the fact that he would be going to Annapolis and becoming a naval officer. He had no interest in the sea, by the way, and Abilene sits in the middle of more dry land than any other place on Earth, and its local river is aptly named the Mud River. But what Ike wanted to do was to get out of Abilene and use his intelligence somewhere where he could make something of himself, and he figured that probably wasn't going to be in Abilene and maybe not even in Kansas. Then at the very last moment, the boy who was ahead of him in the examination by a couple of points fell ill, and his senator said, you know, if you jump up one place, as you will do, you could go right away to the United States Army Academy at West Point, and the United States Military Academy. And Ike, without giving the matter any thought at all, said, fine. Otherwise, he would have gone to Annapolis and become an admiral. You're talking about somebody who was very, very smart, smart enough to pass a highly competitive examination, smart enough to graduate from the Army Staff School as number one, smart enough to be the best bridge and poker player in the United States Army, and smart enough so that when he served as an aide to John J. Pershing and first met General George C. Marshall, or rather, as he then was, Colonel George C. Marshall, who was the Army's unacknowledged talent scout in those days, he carried a little black book in his pocket and wrote down the names of officers who seemed to him suitable for high command in case of war. And on one page, he wrote down, 5 minutes after he'd met Eisenhower, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and always gave Ike the toughest intellectual jobs. Anybody reading the Marshall-Ike correspondence has to be struck by the immense intellectual ability of Eisenhower and his determined breaking down of problems into simple solutions that could be followed one after the other. In addition to which, I should add that while it is bizarre, Mrs. Eisenhower was, as a Jehovah's Witness and a Mennonite, of course, a dyed-in-the-wool pacifist, she nevertheless had an amazing library of military history. I'm not myself sure what to make of that. As a baby in her crib, Stonewall Jackson had ridden past their house with his army on the way to the Battle of Port Royal, which he won. And I like to suppose that some of Stonewall Jackson's spirit had somehow crossed into her cradle and given her an interest in military history. In any case, she had, for Abilene, an amazing military history library, and she encouraged Ike to read it. Before he could read it, she read it to him. And as a schoolboy, he was familiar with everything from Caesar to Hannibal to Thucydides. And one of the reasons why we won the Second World War, there are many reasons, some of them having to do with Ike, many of them having to do with Ike, was when he arrived as an unknown major general in England in 1942, at which point the United States had less than 300 troops in the United Kingdom and had just ended the war, and met Winston Churchill. Within 20 minutes, Churchill had discovered that Ike had read all the books on military history that Churchill knew by heart and was not only able to remember everything in them, but was able to argue with the Prime Minister every single bit of the Trojan Wars or Marlborough's campaigns. And so overnight, Churchill was converted to an enthusiast for this totally unknown American major general who had never seen combat in his life. And that close relationship and trust And that intellectual relationship that existed between Churchill and Ike was, in fact, one of the major assets that helped win us the war in Europe. So Ike was no dummy. Today, we can see, though people could not then, that Ike's outrage at the notion of dropping the atomic bomb on the Japanese, what he was told if the atomic bomb existed, is essentially the point of view of most liberal historians today. It's what Gaël Peretz wrote a whole book about, whether it was he took the view that it was not necessary to drop the atomic bomb on the Japanese at all and that it was a big mistake. Well, so did Ike. Even though he was a Republican to be and a five-star general, he was a very, very smart man.
Folks, I think that's a good place to end it, and unfortunately we have to. Please thank Michael
thank
Korda.
You.
And please join us upstairs at the book signing.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's author event series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.